With us on the line now is Ingrid Newkirk. She's the founder and president of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, the largest animal rights organization in the world. Her campaigns to promote cruelty-free living have made the front pages of newspapers around the world, and a lot of changes have taken place. She was named a top business person of the year in Forbes magazine and is the author of several books, her latest being 250 Vital Things Your Cat Wants You to Know. It's the Cat Guardian's Bible. Welcome to the show, Ingrid.
Thank you, Hannah. Delighted to be on it.
I'm delighted to have you with us on the show. Thanks so much for joining us. And first of all, I just want to say huge applause for setting up PETA. I mean, what a wonderful organization. How long ago was it when you set it all up?
Oh, thank you. It's been since 1980, and so much has changed in that time. People used to make fun of us for saying you shouldn't aspire to get a fur coat as you grew up, and now nobody wants to be seen dead in fur, for example.
Yeah, it's incredible the changes that have happened. I was reading about the beginnings of PETA and what inspired you to start it at the beginning, and even what inspired you to get involved with looking after animals and taking more of an interest. It all started when a neighbour of yours abandoned some kittens, didn't it?
It did, and I had naively thought that all was well and that cats were taken care of, animals were looked after in a civilized world, and I didn't realize there was this enormous homeless cat population, still is, and that the shelters are crammed full of cats looking for homes, which is why we say adopt, never shop. And if you can take two instead of one, that's just grand because they'll keep each other company. I took the little kittens, there were lots of them, down to the local animal refuge. It was run by the government, and it was filthy. It was horrible, and it broke my heart to see it. I've always adored animals. And so I quit my job. I resigned as an apprentice stockbroker and went down and started to look after the cats and the dogs and clean the kennels.
Gosh, what a change going from working as a stockbroker to doing that. How did you find it?
Well, it was rewarding. I mean, there's nothing nicer than to take an animal who is afraid, who is insecure, who has been thrown out of the house, and comfort them and let them know they're loved and that there's hope for them and look after them and make them comfortable. So it was wonderful. It's the best decision I ever made in my life. I haven't looked back. And what's really exciting is that so many other people have learned what they can do. So they never contribute even inadvertently to hurting animals, and they're constantly looking for ways they can help them.
Mm. So in the over 40 years now that PETA has been in existence, what are some of the campaigns or things that you've managed to achieve, changes that have happened that you're most proud of, would you say?
Well, Hannah, I think, the ways in which animals are abused and exploited and dominated and all those things, cut up for bits and pieces of clothing and food, that never stops. You can reduce it. And one of our first successes was to stop dogs and pigs and other animals from being shot by the military in what they called a wound laboratory. And we were able to show that you could actually mark the trajectory of a bullet by shooting into a gel-based block. You didn't have to shoot a dog or a pig. And then we stopped the head injury experiments on baboons. And these were ridiculous. If you watch now for a car commercial and you see a mannequin, a computerized mannequin in a car crash, that's because we stopped every single car company in the world from slamming animals into a wall in a setup like that. There was
Goodness
no excuse
me.
For it. They just hadn't modernized.
No, it's madness, isn't it? When you think of that now, to think that that was ever seen as being okay.
Yes, and it was very hard to change. You know, change is something that people resist. not for good reasons all the time, but they just say, no, I'm not going to change, always done it this way. And our job is a bit hard because we have to say, let's think about that. Do you have to have fur? Do you have to have wool or leather? Do you have to take from animals? And, you know, all the things that we grew up thinking were all right, I think we need to challenge ourselves and ask, are the animals volunteers? Did they give up their skin or their flesh? Did they want to live in your house? Who knows? Did they want to stand on their heads in the circus?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It must be very difficult for you to see. There's a lot of conflict, I think, within people. There's a lot of people out there who are animal lovers, who call themselves animal lovers, but then do things that other people might think, well, how can you be an animal lover if you wear leather, for example, or even if you eat meat? You know, there's a lot of people that do kind of conflicting things, and that's normal to them, but others will see that as not being normal at all.
No, I think things are changing. I mean, when I was growing up, it was very different from now. We had a tiger skin rug. We had ivory ornaments. You know, I went out fishing in the ocean. I just thought it was all fine. But I loved animals. And I was a really slow learner. It took a series of experiences, one by one, for me to think, that I caused suffering to that animal, or, there's something else I can do. And today, you know, there's so many alternatives. It's not how it was. If you ask for something, an alternative that's not made from an animal, or you have vegan cookbooks galore, even celebrities are writing them and posting their recipes, you can, with a little effort, take some personal responsibility and ask yourself, hang on, I do care about animals, not just cats and dogs and horses, but I know they all have feelings like me, and I don't want to inflict any suffering on them.
It is hard for people to make changes, isn't it, a lot of the time, when they're used to living a certain way, they were brought up a certain way, people around them are living the same way as them. To make these big changes, it's sometimes hard for people to think, well, why? Does it really matter? Am I really going to be making much of a difference?
I think it's very important for people to push themselves a little bit because all the changes that we have seen have come about because one person did it and then another person did it. And at PETA, we try to make it as easy as possible. That's why I write these books. That's why we have our PETA.org website. And we show people how handy, how easy, how convenient it can be, and what tastes they're missing if they don't give it a whirl. You know, what other wonderful materials are coming out now from top designers to regular stores. Everything from pineapple leather to tea leaf leather, for goodness sake, to down made from feathers that is from plants. I mean, the world is opening up to all these possibilities, so we don't have to be survivalists anymore like our parents or our grandparents or even me as a child, not thinking too hard, having a fur hat from a cat in Kashmir and thinking it was grand, always choosing the horse carriage because I loved horses. It was just there wasn't enough information, and today there is, and today there are options.
Yeah, it does make a difference having options, doesn't it? It really does. You know, it can be very, very difficult to think about making alternative choices when the options are limited.
Yes, it does require some strength to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, nowadays, I'm in Washington, D.C., and I was in the supermarket yesterday, and here are people picking up, there are rows and rows of soy milk, coconut milk, almond milk, pistachio milk, macadamia milk, and I'm thinking, I know that some of them are doing it for their health, some are doing it for the environment, some are doing it because they've seen the exposés on dairy farms of the calves being taken away from their mothers. It doesn't matter why they're doing it. It's just marvelous that suddenly you can see so much change in front of you. And the young people growing up, I mean, this is when we were growing up, there was nothing like what there is today. So they are leading the way.
Yeah, they really are, aren't they? And milk's a really good example. It's true. It doesn't seem many years ago when it was hard to get hold of soya milk and that was the only alternative to cow's milk. And now, as you say, in the supermarkets, there's rows and rows of so many different varieties and alternatives.
Yes, and when, not that long ago, may go back 15 years, most people didn't know what a vegan was. They thought it was a person from Las Vegas. And I think now you see the word vegan on food everywhere. I was just reading that we've got caveat instead of caviar, for goodness sake. And we've got camembert instead of camembert. So if you want to taste and you want to ask for it, shops are usually anxious to sell you something, so you should have a word with the manager and try to find those things if you can't find them online or somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. So your new book is 250 Vital Things Your Cat Wants You to Know. Why did you decide to write about cats this time?
Well, Hannah, since 2010, there was a big oil spill in the state of Louisiana. BP spilled masses of gallons and gallons, thousands of gallons of oil. And a lot of people lost their jobs in Louisiana because of that spill. They left the state, and many of them left their cats behind. So we went down and bought up maybe 60 and placed them in homes. Three of them are still with us today, a mother, a father, and a child. And in those 10, 12 years, we have learned so much about trying to reduce their trauma, trying to amuse them, when to get them rushed to the vet. I always say rather a vet than a regret. And all of the things we learned by doing and our mistakes and things that I have learned over the years about cats. I thought it would be great to put these tips in a book for people who might want to know why the cat is going outside the box, why not to let the cat outside, how to travel with a cat, you know, how to feed a cat, all sorts of things.
Yeah, no, it's great that it's all in one book. One of the things I really like is talking about why cats squint their eyes, why they close their eyes for more than a split second. It's nice to know what that means. Do tell.
Well, I always say that ownership describes your relationship with a pair of trainers, not with your cat. You are their guardian and they adore you because their whole world revolves around you. You know, you decide when they are going to eat and sleep and so on, and they would rather that you never, ever leave the house. Maybe like Father Christmas, you could leave once a year, but they'd really rather you stay and play with them. So when you see on the internet cats being told, go away, get off my keyboard, and the cat is batting at the iPhone, they want attention, they want love, they're bored. And when they look at you and they squint, they just close their eyes very soon, it means I love you. It's a sign of great affection. It's like that question mark tail that says I'm happy. So if they talk to you, and you know they usually don't talk to each other, they only learn to talk to us to try to get through to humans, then you should always talk back to them in a nice, respectful way.
It is lovely, isn't it, when you get to have we had a talkative cat, and when, I mean, literally, as in making noise, talking and meowing, you ask him a question and then he meows, and then you say something else and he meows, and literally actually having a conversation. It is pretty special when that happens.
Oh, it is. And you do always have to answer them. And I say in the book, you know, they are so attentive. There was, in fact, 2 weeks ago, a study out about how they know spatially where you are. They're not like dogs. They're not, you know, jumping all over you and following you. I love dogs too. But they're keeping track. And when you leave the house, which, again, they hate you to do, you need to stay right there, please, you should bring them something back. It could be a feather. It could be a leaf. But they know that's a present, and they know you remembered them and you bought them something. We have one of our cats, a whole box of feathers that our staff has collected over time, and she will lead you to that box when you come into the room and rub her head into it and say, look what I've got. This is mine.
Oh, lovely. One of the things you mentioned in the book, which I think think is important to mention this time of year, certain house plants that may be hazardous to your cat's health. One of them, I believe, is poinsettias, which are very popular this time of year. You have to be careful if you have a cat.
Absolutely. If someone brings you a gift of a houseplant, poinsettia is dangerous. Anything basically with a heart-shaped leaf can be dangerous. And when they chew on it, a cat's tongue can get swollen and they can not be able to breathe. They will choke. So it's very important wherever you are to find out what the reliable emergency poison control hotline or its equivalent is. Put it on your phone, put it on your fridge so you always have it. And if your cat is poisoned, one thing you can do is gavage them. That means just squirt, get down into them soapy water, warm soapy water, or an equal amount of hydrogen peroxide with water, warm water. And that hopefully will help get the substance out of their system, but rush to the vet. Mm. And I say, you know, people could be staying. You might have a folding bed in the house for guests. Always check down the side before you put it back up, because cats love to get into these small places the way they get into the clothes dryer because it's warm. So you always, always must check before you press the button to start it.
Gosh, yes. What a terrible thought. Dechlorine cats, they don't enjoy that much. As well as obviously you doing something to them physically, they don't like it emotionally. What's the alternative then when they get really, really sharp claws instead of cutting them?
Well, in the book, I do have a diagram of how to cut them, and you should trim them all the time.
Okay.
Never, never, never declaw a cat. I think that vets should be had up if they do it. It is so cruel because it's not taking the nail. It sounds as if it's taking the claw, but it's actually, if you look at your finger, it's taking that first whole segment, the muscle, the tissue, everything off. You take the bone away. And those cats, some of them never recover from it. It disturbs them for life. It stresses them. They feel vulnerable. Some of them stop using a litter box because when they come back out of surgery, they know that they're in pain when they scratch in the litter. But they'll never sometimes walk the same. I mean, we have that word, the cat walk, how we admire the way a cat walks. And yet, if you take away their first digits on their paws, they're not going to be able to walk that way anymore. It does something to their spine. So cut their claws, take them to the vet to have them cut if you can't do it yourself. And if you value your couch more than your cat, you shouldn't have a couch, but you have scratching posts for them, even a piece of log. Make sure to keep it outside and get the insects out of it first for a couple of days. A log, a scratching post, cardboard. If they insist on the couch, spray the couch with a little bit of peppermint or a little bit of lime and pick them up gently, always gently, and move them away from it if they still go there.
Okay. I misunderstood what you meant there. I didn't realize when you're talking about declawing that you meant like actually getting rid of the claw. That's awful. I thought you just meant cutting them. My goodness, that's a different thing altogether. I would never even think of doing that. Do people actually do that then to their cats?
They do, and most people don't realize what it means. They think that it means just trimming the cat.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's a terrible surgical procedure, and in fact, it's not one. It's for every single one of their paws, of their claws.
How awful! My goodness.
It's illegal in some countries, by the way. So
right.
It should be illegal in every country.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a foreword in the book by the actress Kim Basinger, who herself she's a cat rescuer.
Yes, Kim is wonderful. She adores animals. She's helped Peter for years. Some time ago, she helped us actually save a group of beagles who were going to have their legs broken in a laboratory in a pain medication experiment, which was just ludicrous. There are other ways to check. And she saved them with us. She took in a cat that she talks about in 250 Vital Things, who was found in a garbage bag, a rubbish bag. Yeah. That was the vet called her and he said, "If this cat survives, will you take her in?" And I think the cat must have heard that and thought, I would like to live in Hollywood. So the cat pulled through, went to live with Kim, and Kim said for the rest of her life that dear cat slept on her keyboard, and she would never disturb her because she knew she just wanted to be next to her.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure and honour to chat with you, Ingrid Newkirk. I wish we could talk for longer, but unfortunately the show's coming to the end. It would be lovely to chat with you again one day soon. Write another book and then we'll get you on again.
I will indeed. Thank you, Hannah, so much.
Thank you, Ingrid. If listeners want to get a copy of the book we've been talking about, it's called 250 Vital Things Your Cat Wants You to Know.